Thank you very, very much, everybody, for joining. My name is Ali Noorani. I'm the President and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. And today we are here to discuss the nation's response to COVID-19 in the context of immigration policy at our border, but also immigration policy in the context of those who are detained in facilities across the country. While America continues to face the pandemic, President Trump has leveraged the crisis to crack down on immigration in ways that make our country less safe. Since January, the Trump administration, according to our count, and I want to credit our friends at the Cato Institute for getting this work started. Since January, the Trump administration has made nearly 6 changes to immigration policy, ranging from closing specific immigration courts to country or region-specific travel bans to modifying specific visa programs. Now, from a public health perspective, some of these changes are necessary, but many others are cruel and counterproductive. One of the items that we'll be talking about today is a new policy by the administration that was announced last week, a binary choice policy that will force migrant parents to choose between family separation and indefinite detention within crowded, unsanitary facilities. Meanwhile, COVID-19 spreads rapidly within immigration detention facilities, putting detainees, ICE officers, contractors, their families, and entire surrounding communities at risk. This week, ICE confirmed that there are approximately 1,300 cases of COVID among 2,535 detainees tested, a rate of positives far exceeding the national average. And that's only a small fraction of the more than 25,000 people inside detention facilities. Testing capacity, quite frankly, remains severely limited. That's why I'd say we're calling on the Trump administration to explore alternative, compassionate solutions that will reduce the spread of coronavirus within these facilities and keep families together. Our first speaker is Larry Benenson, Assistant Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the National Immigration Forum. Let me just pause before I turn over to Larry, I'm sorry. After we go through a short panel of speakers, as Megan said, we will tee up an opportunity for press to ask questions. So each speaker will present for about 1.5-2 minutes, and then we'll tee up the questions from press after that. So Larry, thank you.
Hi, thanks Ali, and thank you for allowing me to join this important discussion today. As we all know by now, the coronavirus has an increased risk of spreading from person to person when social distancing is impossible or when it's ignored. Of course, in detention facilities that house immigrants, 6 feet of social distancing is often impossible, and this can lead to additional infections and even deaths. When it comes to the area of criminal detention, Republican and Democratic governors are releasing at-risk individuals from prisons and jails to reduce the spread of COVID-19. However, the difference with immigration detainees is that they are not detained primarily for committing a crime. Instead, they're held during and after administrative removal proceedings. So the question then becomes, if public officials can safely release people convicted of a crime, why can't they do the same for civil immigration facilities? Ultimately, the spread of coronavirus in ICE facilities is a public health crisis for all Americans. And as the virus spreads in detention facilities, it threatens not only the health and safety of those detained, but also of others in the facility, whether it's ICE employees, contract employees, attorneys, visitors, guards, maintenance staff, as well as the community at large as the virus continues to spread. That's why we call on ICE to immediately release nonviolent immigration detainees, the overwhelming majority of immigrant detainees, and rely on alternatives to detention, or ATDs. ATDs are cost-effective, and they work. ATDs, including things like case management and technology like tracking devices, can be used to ensure immigrants show up to court hearings and adhere with immigration rulings. Decreasing the number of immigrants in immigration detention would reduce the burden on the country's strained healthcare system and make communities safer. And the benefits of minimizing immigration detention during the coronavirus pandemic are clear. So we urge the Trump administration to continue to reduce the number of immigrants detained in ICE custody immediately. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Larry. Our next speaker is Sheriff Jim Manfrey from Flagler County in Palm Coast, Florida. Sheriff Manfrey is here also on behalf of LEAP, the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. Sheriff, let me turn it over to you. Thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me today, and hello to all on the call. My name is Jim Manfrey. I'm a retired sheriff from Flagler County. I've had a 25-year in law career in law enforcement, working as an investigator in the city of New York, a prosecutor out in Suffolk County, Long Island, and two terms as sheriff in Flagler County, which is just north of Daytona Beach. I've been a 5-year member of LEAP as a national speaker. LEAP is made up of 5,000 judges, prosecutors, sheriffs, chiefs of police, corrections officer, all dedicated to reforming the criminal justice system and suggesting best practices. The coronavirus pandemic has placed a significant burden on so many of us, particularly law enforcement, medical personnel, and the entire criminal justice system. All have had to react differently and change their policies and procedures to protect both employees and the public. As a former law enforcement official, I'm seriously concerned about the clear public health dangers detention facilities are facing, including immigration detention facilities. There are about 2.1 million people incarcerated in the United States. 1.3 are in state facilities, 600,000 are in county facilities, and about 250,000 in federal facilities. The nature of inmate facilities and detention facilities is it's congregant living. There's no way of separating people. People are constantly cycling in and out of those facilities. And even in its best days, detention facilities are unsanitary and have limited access to healthcare. These are breeding grounds for this pandemic. That's why large populations of detainees pose risk not only to themselves, but also to corrections officers and their surrounding communities. If this virus is allowed to continue its spread through our detention facilities, it will not be contained here. Government should take immediate steps to address this massive threat to public health. Law enforcement has a very inconsistent response to this. Some county and federal officials are acting responsibly, but many are not. We need to reduce the population of detainees. We must start by releasing nonviolent felony offenders like those who are in immigration detention and who do not pose serious risk to the broader community. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff Manfrey. Our next speaker is Ashley Feasley, Director of Policy, Migration, and Refugee Services Offices at the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Ashley, thank you.
Thank you, Ali. Hello and good morning. My name is Ashley Feasley, and I'm the Director of Policy and Public Affairs for Migration and Refugee Services at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Our organization provides services for refugees, unaccompanied children, and we also serve immigrant detainees and asylum-seeking families. The bishops believe and have the mission of their work is very much centered around the idea that we are only as healthy as the most vulnerable among us, and every human being is made in the likeness of Christ and thus deserves and is deserving of human decency. The crisis that we're seeing unfolding inside the ICE detention facilities has made the fact all the more clear that we are all human and we are all connected. When immigrant detainees are at risk of contracting COVID-19, that means that the staff, their families, and entire surrounding communities are at risk as well. This is something that we need to be working to avoid from a public health angle, and also from a human decency angle. We have a moral responsibility to ensure the health and safety of immigrants and refugees. The Catholic bishops have issued statements of solidarity for immigrant detainees and also have guidelines that they suggested for safe and compliant release for certain detainees. We need an immediate plan to halt the spread of the COVID-19 within ICE detention facilities. There are alarming new reports of detained families facing possible separation in the form of needing to choose whether to have release for their child or remain detained indefinitely. Although the details around this so-called binary choice policy are unclear, the need to keep families together is paramount, and it is central to our values, both as people of faith, but also as Americans. Giving parents an impossible choice of accepting indefinite family detention during a pandemic or being separated from their children is heartbreaking. Additionally, it is proven to be something that can be scientifically damaging and traumatic to children. And it also goes against the best policies that we have as it relates to safe and compliant release in the form of alternatives to detention. We as a country have principles to help ensure that children have the best safety and the best interest at hand while they're in government custody, whether they are in with their parents or whether they're alone. And children should always be placed in the least restrictive setting and family-safe environments. Our policies do say that, and we ask the government to continue to honor those policies. Given the risks of COVID-19 in immigrant detention settings, the federal government should work to keep families together using alternatives to detention that utilize case management. And the government should also consider releasing nonviolent immigrant detainees and those who are vulnerable to COVID-19 as well, and enrolling them in alternatives to detention. These are suggestions that could be made today that save the taxpayer money, and most importantly, are in the lines of good public health policy. Thank you very much, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you so much, Ashley. Our next speaker is Brianna Stensrud. She is the director of the campaign. Welcome, Brianna.
Thank you for including me today. I am Brianna Stensrud. I'm the director of Welcome, which is a community of Christian women dedicated to creating a movement of Christ-like welcome for immigrants and refugees who are arriving here in the United States. For me and many evangelicals, immigrants are first and foremost people made in the image of God, and we are deeply compelled to care about this plight, about their plight. And we don't see immigration as a political issue. We see it as a biblical issue, a human dignity issue. Last year, I traveled with a group of women across the border to Oaxaca, Mexico, where I had the opportunity to visit with migrant children and their families traveling to the U.S. from Central America. And we had the honor of meeting with mothers like Lorena, who traveled from Honduras with her husband and two children, who fled Honduras due to gang violence at their home and in their community. And it was surprising to me, I don't know why, but they did not want to leave. And why would you want to leave your home? Why would you want to go somewhere else where you have roots? But they loved their country. They didn't want to leave. But as Lorena told us, and as many of us can understand, parents will do whatever they need to do in order to keep their children safe. So when I see families like these now exposed to this current pandemic, and they're forced to decide between two gut-wrenching options, whether they should split up to keep their families or their children safe, or to stay together indefinitely in unsafe conditions, I am devastated. I'm appalled. These are vulnerable people in our care and our oversight, and we can do better. We must do better. The inherent dignity of immigrants and refugees should not be controversial, nor is it a partisan issue. We must move forward toward an approach that acknowledges safety concerns, but anchors those concerns in an ocean of compassion that leads us to a humane and dignified outcome for these families. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brianna. Our final speaker is Donna Abbott, Senior Vice President for Global Refugee and Immigrant Services at Bethany Christian Services. Donna.
Hi. As mentioned, I'm Donna Abbott, Senior Vice President of Bethany Christian Services. We are a global child and family services agency. We have assisted refugees in their resettlement, refugees and immigrants in their resettlement into communities throughout the United States for the last 40 years. The administration's recent binary choice practice, which forces asylum-seeking parents to choose between separating from their children and indefinite detention within crowded, unsanitary facilities, is nothing short of horrifying. Separating children from a primary caregiver, according to Harvard Center for the Developing Child, can cause permanent psychological distress and impacts cognitive development. Asking a parent to make a choice between their child's long-term emotional health and short-term physical health is cruel. During a crisis like the pandemic, it is the parent who will offer and assure the best protection to their child. The child feels the safest when it is with their parent who is making the necessary decisions for their well-being. Every parent deserves to have the resources needed to provide the protection, to provide that protection to themselves, their child, and their community. Unaccompanied children by law have the right to be assessed for potential trafficking and legal relief. This right has been suspended and should be immediately reinstated. Foster care programs like Bethany have a very long history of providing safe, community-based care for these children while an assessment is occurring. Foster care providers, guided by the Office of Refugee Resettlement Policy, have long-standing procedures in place for assuring the well-being of any child with a communicable disease or in jeopardy of catching a communicable disease while assuring the safety of the fostering family and community. Under both the Democratic and Republican administration, asylum-seeking children arriving without guardians are offered foster care, which includes education, medical care, and the opportunity to make their case for remaining in the U.S. They're only deported after officials have ensured they have a safe home to return to. As a nation, we can do better than family separation, remain in Mexico, and binary choice. These children and families face clear and present dangers in their home countries, and unfortunately in immigration jail. We do not need to choose between safety from COVID-19 transmission and saving the life of a refugee and immigrant families and children. We can and should do both. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you so much. So before I turn it over back to Megan, I just wanted again to thank our panelists for joining us today and to restate the purpose of this call is that we are urging the Trump administration to immediately reverse its binary choice policy and explore more compassionate solutions that include alternative detention in order to reverse the spread of coronavirus within detention facilities. So Megan, let me turn it over to you to lay out the instructions for questions, please.
At this time, we'll move into Q&A. If you have a question, please indicate by using the raise hand function on Zoom and we will unmute you. Please ask one question at a time and re-queue if you have additional questions. When you're unmuted, please introduce yourself.
Great. So while we pause and everybody scrambles to find the raise hand button on their respective Zoom screens, I wanted to send a question to Donna and Ashley and others if they would like to jump in. But, you know, for families who are in detention facilities, what are the specific alternatives to detention that you believe are the right step for families?
Bethany was part of the family case management program, which provided case management services to families released to community while awaiting asylum procedures. That program was highly successful. 90% of families showed up for their immigration proceedings. There is now wraparound services being offered as a family case management step two program, which provides a lot of the same services, education, support, referral. They can assure training on COVID-19, preventing COVID-19 spread. For matter of fact, that material has been translated in numerous languages, both via video and written.
I would just want to add that the family case management program that Donna talked about is a really important development that the Obama administration and the beginning of the Trump administration used for families in lieu of detention. As Donna mentioned, there's a high level of compliance that the families had with their immigration court proceedings, but it also was a huge cost saver to the federal government. Detention beds for families are very expensive. They're over $300 per day per individual. We know that these alternatives to detention programs are much cheaper on the daily cost basis. They can be anywhere from about $35 to $45 a day. One of the reasons why they are cheaper is that we are utilizing community support, we're utilizing shelter and resources of a family and loved one. And so we're able to very much incorporate those types of cost savings to the U.S. taxpayer and ensure the compliance that Donna mentioned, while at the same time providing less traumatizing and more child-friendly situations for families.
Sure, thank you. Thank you both. Sheriff Manfrey, you spoke a little bit about the different numbers between federal facilities, state facilities, and county facilities. In your experience, particularly at the county level, or your experience with any of these facilities, can you speak a little bit more to, what are the typical measures that taken to, ensure the health of detainees?
Well, again, it's difficult simply because most of this, most of the living inside of these facilities are congregate. There's usually very few isolation cells that are in any of these facilities. Simply because they're built to be as inexpensive as possible to the public. So the measures really are things that are atypical to these facilities. Generally, when people are sick, you're able to isolate them. In a pandemic, which so many of them are potentially ill, it creates a huge problem. The basic issue is for the detention facility operators is to lock everybody down, which is not a good long-term strategy. That leads to a lot of issues of isolation and so forth. But also people coming in and out of the facility. So even if you had a robust testing, you literally have to test everyone, especially in the county facilities or all the intake facilities of the state or county or federal. You have to provide testing for everyone coming into the facility, and you have to provide testing for everyone who's been in the facility. So the challenges is to separate people who are in the facility long-term, who have not been exposed to the public recently, from those who are recently coming in from the public. So it's a challenge of space, it's a challenge of manpower, it's a challenge of testing, if there's enough money for testing and adequate testing. A lot of that has been the case where the testing is inadequate. So it's a tremendous challenge. And you're not only concerned with the detainees, you're concerned about your personnel who are being exposed regardless of how much you mask and sanitize. So this is providing a huge challenge. That's why it's the simple way of limiting these issues is by depopulating these facilities and providing alternatives to detention. Some of the things that have already been suggested are whether it's ankle bracelets or just some sort of monitoring of nonviolent felony offenders are the solution. And the simple solutions, and also every inmate facility operator knows who is in that facility. They know who are the elderly, they know who are at the end of their sentence. These are things that are readily available. It's not like they have to make up new measures or new software. So clearly, elderly inmate detainees should be released. People who are medically challenged should be released. Those at the end of their sentence should be released. People who are cycling in should be put on bail or some sort of alternative to bail rather than being incarcerated. And a huge amount of these people, like every detainee, they have not been convicted of anything. Two-thirds of county inmate facilities are still waiting trial. So, and the same thing with detainees. They are not been convicted of anything. So we should respect their rights, and we should respect the challenges that you're presenting in law enforcement by depopulating as quickly as we can and as safely as we can.
Thank you, Sheriff. Thank you. It looks like we have a question here. I'm going to unmute your line. Go ahead.
Hi there. My name is Elisa Resnick. I'm a reporter with Arizona Public Media. I'm not sure if others here have the answer to this question, but this question is for Sheriff Jim Manfrey. I'm hoping to see, when you talk about the different types of detention centers and prisons, whether they're state-run, federally run, or privately run, is there any indication that we have so far of how tests are obtained and paid for, depending on the type of detention center that it is? I mean, for example, if it's a state-run center, is it paid? Are these tests paid for and obtained by the state, or is it still by ICE, or is it by the private company that owns it? Go ahead.
So again, if you're talking about if they're county facilities, it's the individual county's Department of Health who are providing, in my understanding, are providing these tests, which is a huge problem. This is the basic problem with the federal government not creating the standardization and taking over all testing. So you're now leaving it up to individual counties, of which we have somewhere about 2,500 counties in this country, each trying to provide testing or pain tests, each going out and trying to procure this. So you have different testing done in each county in this country. You then have the state itself with state facilities who have their own Department of Health and Corrections who are providing testing. And then you have the federal government who has their own testing. So part of it is the inconsistency, because the federal government hasn't said, look, this is the test that we have, we believe is the best. This is the one we can provide to everyone. So you have consistency of results. So it really depends on where you are. For immigration detainees who are in county facilities, they are, even though they're under ICE detention or detainers, they are still under the care of that county. So they are specifically going to be affected by that county's Department of Health policies, their ability to fund tests. Counties are and states are at great financial risk right now because of the lack of economic activity and sales tax, which a lot of counties and states depend on. So this is another example why the federal government should have an overall response to testing and it's not just the test, it's also the results. So, I mean, some counties are overwhelmed by the amount of testing that's being done. And so it's not just getting the tests, it's also getting the results. So the inconsistency throughout the country provides a huge risk to the detainees and to the employees and to the public.
Great, thank you. And Larry, I know you've been also following the data here pretty closely. Anything that you wanted to add?
Yeah, I would just, adding on to that, in terms of where testing has taken place for immigration detainees, it's unclear exactly how that is proceeding. ICE has released some overall data, 1,300 confirmed cases across 50 plus facilities. And ICE has released data on where the confirmed cases have happened, anywhere from, one detainee being positive for coronavirus up to 150 or so in a particular facility. But the only data in terms of testing is there's just an overall number, 2,600 tests. We don't know if, the tests are concentrated solely at ICE-run facilities, at third-party facilities. There are private, private prison companies that contract with ICE to hold immigration detainees. And, as the sheriff mentioned, also immigration detainees are held often by contract at state local facilities. So it's unclear where this testing has occurred, at least in terms of immigrant detainees, and whether the 50 or so facilities that have positive tests, if they're the only ones where there are, in fact, positive cases. If no testing is occurring at a particular facility, we may not be aware of a particular localized outbreak, and that also poses severe risks, to staff of those facilities as well as the detainees, but also the broader public in those areas.
Great, thank you, Larry. Bree, I had a question for you. If you could take a second to give people a better sense of the community that you are building and working with, but then also among this community, how are these, what are the questions that you are hearing from the community that's being built, whether it's around what's happening in detention facilities or what is happening with families along the border.
Sure. Welcome is a collaborative project between the National Immigration Forum and World Relief. And in this project, we have a fairly large social community of conservative Christian women who are very concerned and are wanting to learn and enter into the space of immigration from a biblical faith perspective. And they're wanting to do so in a way that is safe and that brings them along in a journey of understanding. And so that is my role in doing that, is to kind of shepherd that, disciple that journey into understanding what this issue is, as we know it's vast and complex, but there are thousands and thousands of evangelical women who are very unsettled by the changes that have been made by this current administration. And they are feeling compassion. They are feeling empathy for these families, for these mothers and children who are finding themselves in very vulnerable situations. And frankly, they are appalled at the treatment that they are receiving at our border or in our facilities. And this community is very new to the subject, but they are very interested. They are paying attention and they are wanting to understand how they can make a difference and how they can make a change happen very tangibly for these families. I would say the common questions we get in our social communities with women who are involved with Welcome are definitely about safety concerns, not only for US citizens, but also the families that are being detained or the families that are approaching our border and seeking asylum. Many of them, I would say most of them, do not understand the process in which we allow people into this country. They don't understand vetting. They don't understand a lot of the things that are incredibly complex, which a lot of us don't necessarily understand from day to day, specifically with all of the changes that have been happening. So our job is to encourage, educate, and equip them on how to enter into this space and advocate well. And we see many of them doing that. So we do have questions about safety. We also have questions about how can this be happening? Why is this happening? And of course, we all know there's quite a history as to why this is happening and how this is happening. And we've had a change in demographics of who is coming and why people are coming, and that has affected the reasonings and the conditions to where we are today. And that's part of our job, is to help bring them along in that. But their ears are perked, they are listening. And I do think that we're going to soon see a day when these women will raise their voice and say, this is completely unacceptable. They're saying this in the safety of our group. They're leaning into learning. And they know that this is inhumane. They know that this is a disgrace to the bigger church in our country. And they feel like it's un-American, that we would not treat people like this. And so I'm encouraged by this group of evangelical women. We've got about nearly 70,000 in our Facebook community who are actively listening and paying attention and want to engage. And they've got lots of questions, and we are doing our best to shepherd those in a way that helps them feel empowered to call and to make change and have courageous conversations in their communities, churches, and with elected officials.
Thank you so much, Bree. Any last questions? Feel free to raise your hand or drop a question into the chat box. I just, again, really want to thank the panel here today, Larry Bennetson with the Forum, our Assistant Vice President of Policy and Advocacy, Sheriff Jim Manfrey from Flagler County in Palm Coast, Florida, also with the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. And it looks like, I'm sorry, we have one more question. Apologies. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. I'm sorry. It looks like you're okay. It looks like I'm the only one asking questions. Apologies on that. I will let you guys go soon. I just have this last question for Brianna. Can you talk a little bit more about where your group, where women who are a part of your group are located? For example, are they kind of spread across the country? Are they in Arizona at all? And do you see there being sort of a turning point where people start speaking up more from this group that you're talking about?
Yes, thanks for the question. We see that we are broadly, really across the U.S., I would say we do have a good concentration kind of in the South and the Southeast, but I would say that we are pretty broad across the U.S. What I will say is that this is a group that is newer to this human dignity issue, but very, very interested, and they are starting to take steps as they feel confident to do so. Those steps might be small as far as talking with a family member or a friend or encouraging their church leadership to have more conversations or allow for or approve resources that have these, that generate these conversations. We know that there are women who are already voicing their concerns. We know that there are women who are already calling their elected officials or sending emails. This is a group that is trying to enter into a space that is pretty complicated from them and multifaceted in their entire life. And the fact that a lot of these conservative women don't feel that they've got a space to talk about necessarily with their family or even in their churches or even in their communities. They're in a pretty homogenous bubble. And yet they feel very empathetic and they are stirred to compassion about this issue. And they know that this, what's happening and all of the vast changes that are being made, it's hard to keep up with, but they are, their ears are perked and they're paying attention and they want to be equipped. The number one question we have in our group is, what can I do? And we give them a menu of options that go from engaging in courageous conversations with your community to advocating within your faith community. And then also how do we advocate in the political sense and equip them to do so? Does that answer your question?
Sorry, Eliza, does that answer your question? Sorry.
It does answer my question. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. No, thank you. So again, thank you everybody for joining. Sheriff Jim Manfrey with Flagler County, Pompous Lord, also with the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. Ashley Friesley, Director of Policy, Migration and Refugee Services Office with the USCCB. Brianna Stensrud, Director of Welcome. And then Donna Abbott, Senior Vice President for Global Refugee and Immigrant Services at Bethany Christian Services. We will be sending around a statement and the recording of this conversation shortly. Please do contact Megan Wetmore or Joanna Taylor at the Forum's Comm Shop if you would like to connect with any of the speakers. Thank you again. Hope everybody stays safe and stays healthy. And take care and thank you. Bye.